Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and me, Tris Dixon. Thank you so much for the support of the podcast since we got up and running about 15 or 16 weeks ago now, I think it is. If you haven't had a listen, go back and check out our archives where we cover topics including Frank Bruno, Nassim Hamed, Mike Tyson, and many, many more. Been a lot of laughs along the way, and it's been a lot of fun, and appreciate all of your feedback. We actually said that coming into this week, we would take another listener Q&A, and that's what we're doing. So, gents, start your engines, because Jason asks who your favourite boxers are from first watching boxing until now. So that's to all three of us. His Hagler, Bruno, Ben, Lewis, and Hatton. In this era, he's gone for Golovkin, Fury, and Bivol. Rawley, let's start with you. Where do you start? Where do you stand with this in terms of having favourites? Are you even allowed favourites? You know, I can't say I've ever been allowed them as such.
Well, yeah, you do. Of course you do. If there's people you like watching more than others, there's people with a crowd-pleasing style, there's people with lovely boxing skills. But, I mean, the one I admired, my boyhood hero, and I think for anybody of my sort of age, and I suspect Ian will say the same, is Muhammad Ali. You know, as a little boy, I was a little boy from the east end of Sheffield, from the little semi-detached house over there, and I admired and hero-worshipped the Olympic champion, world champion from Louisville, Kentucky. I mean, Muhammad Ali was my all-time hero. So, yeah, he's the one I looked up to and admired more than any other. But over the years, I mean, there've been a lot of them. I go along with a lot of people that your questioner there has got on his list. I mean, Nigel Benn, I always loved watching and commentating on just simply because he was so exciting. I was a big admirer of Lennox Lewis. I thought he was a class act in a time when heavyweight boxing was not always very classy at all. And into the modern era, you know, people like Joe Calzaghe and right up to date, I think Tyson Fury, those three fights I was lucky enough to commentate on against Deontay Wilder, I think are right up there with the most dramatic fights I've seen.
Ian, how about you, Ian?
Well, I go back a bit further. First of all, I've got to apologise because I've got a bit of a sore throat today. And I was very touched there by John's description of him coming from humble start in the east end of Sheffield. I thought he was going to go on like one of those boxer stories there. But
I could hear the inspirational HBO music in the background.
Yeah, yeah. 24/7 with John Rawling. When I was a kid, you know, it was listening to fights on the radio that first got me interested. And I remember my dad listening to fights, you know, with Dick Richardson and Joe Erskine, who are, you know, people like that. I remember seeing him later. He was a lovely, smooth boxer for a heavyweight. So you really are going back to the 50s. He fought Rocky Marciano. I think, Trish, you probably know better than me. You're a sort of a walking Bible about everything that happened in boxing. That he put up a very good show in that fight. Like John says, I mean, everybody, Cassius Clay, as he first was. Do you remember, they used to put his fights on Grandstand or BBC One, Saturday lunchtime. You know, this is a guy that predicted what round the fight would end. And yes, it did end in that round. So he captured all our imaginations. Later on, Howard Winston, what a wonderful boxer he was. Kevin Finnegan, among those middleweights, you know, smooth as silk. Fought Hagler, just got cut to bits, but he fought beautifully that night. Kirkland Lang, Nigel Benn, Mike Tyson. And, you know, I think the best fighter I ever saw, Sugar Ray Leonard, who could both box like a dream, could make punching look like poetry. but could hit as well, as Tommy Hearns found out.
Yeah, I think my answer, I think I've gone into three different categories for this. I've gone into, maybe it's just because I've just done a long interview with Robin Reed on Boxing Life Stories, but when I was an amateur coming through, I was looking up to Steve Collins, Robin Reed, and Lennox. I think in terms of being covering the sport, I can't think of a stronger trio than Manny Pacquiao, Carl Froch, and Amir Khan for giving me thrills and spills. And then in terms of my nostalgic three and people who I couldn't learn enough about would probably be Matthew Saad Mohammed, Aaron Pryor, and a toss-up between Jack Dempsey or Floyd Patterson, who I think were both intriguing characters. Mm. So that's where I'd sit. James Clifford asks this. What are the fellas' views on having an active boxer joining the commentary team for a broadcast and commenting on a potential future opponent's fight? Mm. Ian, let's start with you.
In general, don't like the idea an awful lot. I just like the guy sitting alongside you, the analyst, to be seeing fighter A against fighter B with no loaded agenda, or hoping that one guy wins and kind of maybe even doing his scoring along that basis. You know, it's like wishful thinking. So having said that, and I've told the story before on this podcast, but it's worth telling again, you know, the lucky way we ended up with Evander Holyfield sitting alongside us and doing a bit of co-commentary on the night that Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson. So, you know, it worked that night in an editorial way. But generally, I think I probably don't like the idea, but, you know, again, and it won't be for the first time, people will call me a dinosaur.
John?
I think, by and large, I don't like the idea. I think it's absolutely fine to have somebody, you know, in the studio alongside your presenter as a pundit to give their view on a fight and then to be asked about the potential of a fight coming up. But I don't like the idea of them actually being involved in the commentary because, as Ian says, it creates a bias. And that's something which, you know, as a commentator, you want to be trying to avoid. You want to try and keep it as level as possible.
It's funny. Yeah, obviously, I think that the thing is that with the question from James there is, you know, do you want someone impartial calling the action as they see it, or do you want someone to start mapping out the next part of a storyline, really? Which I kind of get. I mean, one thing that I think was interesting about this question, which struck a chord with me, is in the research for my Matthew Saad Mohammed book, which is out now, isn't it, Ian? But you can buy it now.
Buy it now this Christmas. First on your shopping list.
Well, I... gets me every time. There's a fight in there where Matthew Saad Mohammed's team are at loggerheads with Mike Rossman's team in Philadelphia, and they've had a dispute, and Mike Rossman's dad and trainer Jimmy DiPiano is called in for co-commentary on Saad Mohammed against Yaki Lopez. And he just buries Saad Mohammed for 11 or 12 rounds till the point where the commentator turns around to him and says, "You don't want Matthew to win, do you?" Which is, you know, he just every time, everything negative he says, he says, which was interesting. So, John, one specifically for you here from John Hannon. Mm-hmm. He says, just spotted after you. I'll go here. John makes it clear that he likes you. However, when Josh Warrington was with Frank Warren and he fought Kid Galahad, John made a point of putting Barry on the spot about the drugs ban, which was completely the right thing to do. But John has never done the same with Tyson Fury or Billy Joe, and he's had ample opportunity. Is that because they're both Warren fighters?
No, it's not. The reason that was the case was, I mean, at that time I was doing stuff to help publicize the forthcoming fights, you know, press conferences and the like. And I spoke to Josh and his father prior to the press conference, and they clearly thought that this was an issue and wanted it discussed. And that's the reason that I went down the route that I did. And the fact that Kid Galahad had got the positive test in the past, that's why it was introduced into the dialogue. If I was feeling brave, and if Deontay Wilder had done the same to Tyson Fury, then yes, of course, I'd have had to have you know, sort of carried the conversation on. It wasn't me specifically who was having a go or questioning or raising doubts against Kid Galahad. I was merely providing the debate platform on which this could be spoken about.
Well, the jury will now retire and consider its verdict.
In the meantime, you can go and buy Warrior now, apparently.
I've got a question for you, Tris. I've got a question.
Go on.
Are the only people who are writing in with inquiries people whose names begin with J? Because we've had Jason, James and John so far.
Yeah, so far. And it's not even done alphabetically. You would have thought I'm trying to do this, but I'm not. But in terms of what John's just said there as well, sometimes you've got to pick your spots, and it's not always easy to ask the deep and meaningful question. There's a time and a place. It's like, I remember, you know, you can't get your stuff in just for the sake of getting it in. I remember someone asking Mike Tyson about the rape out of nowhere on a talk show, and I'm like, you know, it just was, and he lost it, and it just wasn't the time or the place. Like, I understand you want to cover certain things,
yeah,
but you do have to pick your time. And obviously, in terms of John mentioning these names, Billy Joe, Tyson and Galahad, I've sat down with all three of them, but I've had different agendas set by whether it's my podcast or BT. And when I say different agendas, I mean, if I go and do a 5-minute grab with Tyson Fury to sit down to talk about the Wilder fight, chances are that there's not going to be time to talk about a drug issue from 6 or 7 years ago in that 5 minutes, because the brief is to get a couple of lines on Wilder. It just depends on how things are going. So it's not always as easy as it seems, although obviously we do want to always get the questions answered that people do, you know, that people do want. But sometimes it's sometimes easier said than done. And I think on that same platform, I have asked Billy Joe about it. I have asked Barry about it, and not Tyson, but then when it's flipped around, I've done other stuff with Tyson and not done the other two. So I don't know. It just depends. You've got to pick your spot sometimes.
Well, I remember when Tyson Fury was making his comeback after the exile. There was an ITV reporter, and he's going to have to forgive me, I don't recall his name, but he turned up at the press conference. I think it was a Safari press conference, you know, the actual fight which he had as his comeback contest. And he began to try to speak about issues like this and about what had gone. And he was totally and utterly blanked. You know, there was just zero comments, and it was made very apparent that if this continued, he was going to be invited to leave the press conference. You know, so it's not always as easy as people might imagine.
Yeah, but I don't like that idea, do you? I mean, people being thrown out of press conferences. Don't have a press conference if you don't like the questions. If you have a press conference, you've got to field the questions. You know, it's a bit like Alex Ferguson in football, you know, trying to ban people from the meetings. No, I don't agree with that at all. I actually think if you've done something, you're almost like a public property when you become a top sportsman. So I think you've got to face the music and face the questions. Tris is right. The context is everything. And if you're only doing a 2-minute grab and it's meant to be about the fight, you haven't got time to go in their background. But if it's a big profile piece about somebody, yeah, you'd be failing in your job, really, to not raise the subject.
I was just pointing out that, you know, for people who think that sometimes these questions are avoided, actually, sometimes it's not as easy as you might imagine to ask these questions. I always have great admiration for Colin Hart. Do you remember that time at the press conference when he said to Lennox Lewis, when there were all sorts of rumours flying around, which of course been subsequently massively disproved, but Colin said, "Excuse me, Lennox, I'm being asked to ask this by my editor. This is not me. Are you gay?"
Really? Wow.
It's one of the most extraordinary questions I've ever heard at a press conference.
Yeah. I did Mike Tyson at the Grosvenor House Hotel, top floor, for half an hour when he arrived to fight Francis up in Manchester. And I knew at one point in the interview I would have to ask him about, you know, what had happened with the rape case and him being jailed. And, you know, but funnily enough, you know, it was like he kind of knew, and he raised the subject himself. And he said, you know, and I know people will ask me about that girl, he said, and I never did that, he said, but I did a lot of other things that I should have gone to jail for. So I'm not complaining. Yeah. So, you know, in a way, he helped me from having to raise it, which I would have done, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Some good stuff there, gents. Thank you. So a question from Dean Barks. This one is to both of you. What made you both a fan of boxing, and who are your favorite fighters? So we've done the favorite fighters, but John, what sparked your interest in actual boxing? What was the catalyst?
That's a difficult one. I suppose my dad was interested. He'd have been the one who got me up at strange times and put it on television and said, "Come on, sit down and watch this." So I suppose that was a factor. But I think the thing that always appeals and appealed to me about boxing is that there's no bullshit in the sport. You know, there might be a lot of it around the sport, but once they actually get in the ring, there's no hiding place. And I think that at times it can be a very dishonest sport, but at times, other times, it can be a brutally honest sport. There's no hiding place. You're not relying on teammates. You're going out there to try and prove that you're the superior man. And I still find that an appealing concept to this day, despite all the question marks about boxing in so many ways.
Yeah.
Was that what you mentioned in terms of you listening on the radio as a kid? The thing that lit the spark for you?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I think that, you know, my father died when I was very young, when I was only 9. And I remember him listening to fights on the radio, and something I've always remembered every time I think about him, and kind of how he set me on a path in a way in my life by doing that. And later, you know, my brother, Michael, he was very much into boxing as well. And he used to talk about the fighters and the fights to me too. So I guess it happens by like almost like an osmosis. I think that is a great point that John makes about, you know, it can be pretty distasteful and brutal and barbaric and horrible sometimes, boxing, but it can also be absolutely beautiful and wonderfully dramatic. And I always used to wonder as a kid, I think, well, here's these two guys belting each other for, you know, the best part of an hour. And at the end, they're like best friends. They're hugging each other. And there's this lovely kind of fusion of spirit between even the most, you know, fighters who have got a big grudge going on. Somehow that all goes away in the ring, doesn't it? And you often hear how they become friends in later life. Like, I remember being in Las Vegas for a fight, and Jim Watt, you know, often old fighters that he'd fought or knew him would come over and give him a hug. I love that.
Yeah, some great stuff there. We've got this from Bill Number One, not a parody, also known as at the Big Bill. I like this one. Which boxers, maybe after their first few fights or after a run of defeats, surprised you by going on to achieve major success? So I'll start off with this one. I think, you know, I love seeing these Cinderella stories like your Steve Robinsons and now a Maxie Hughes, guys that, you know, might have been condemned to scrap heap in 1 year or another, but have come back to have tremendous runs. I think the one that really stands out for me, though, is probably Irish Mickey Ward, who actually walked away from the sport for a number of years and then returned. And obviously his subsequent comeback wound up with those three magnificent fights with Arturo Gatti and financial security that it looked like he was nailed on for at the end of the 80s and early 90s before things went sour. So I would say I took a lot of enjoyment seeing Mickey Ward's final years and him getting the credit and the financial recompense that he deserved. John, how about you? Guys who surprised you by going on to achieve major success?
Well, you mentioned the name of the one who is for me, and that's Steve Robinson, who incidentally celebrated his 54th birthday, which will be last week as this goes to air, as people are watching. If they want to just look back on a little video that BBC Wales put out, and I actually tweeted it, so if you find me on Twitter and look for it, you see Steve Robinson working out at the age of 54, and he's just still most extraordinary physical shape. You know, he puts some 25-year-olds to shame with the way in which he's kept himself fit. But, you know, I mean, he was nowhere really, and he got the opportunity as a late substitute to fight for a world title. And he not only took his place in that fight, he actually won it. And he became for a year or two a bit of a Welsh folk hero. Of course, it all ended in 1995 when he lost to Nazim Hamed in Cardiff. But before then, he had some excellent performances, including a victory over Duke McKenzie late in his career. Admittedly, Duke was close to the end of his career, as I say. But, you know, Steve still beat a very good fighter there. And I think he produced and achieved so much more than he himself would have believed.
Mm. Ian, how about you? Anyone that springs to mind?
Well, obviously, I think you've got to throw Dennis Andrews, haven't you, into that mix, who was kind of perceived as just a tough journeyman and went on to become a world champion. And another name maybe we should throw in here is Johnny Nelson, you know, because Johnny, you know, I think by his own admission, was pretty hopeless when he started out, you know, losing fights, and he turned it around to become a very successful world champion. Okay, not all of his fights were spine-tinglingly exciting, but you know, he made a great living from the sport and has gone on to become a top broadcaster and television man. So, you know, loved working with Johnny all those years, and good luck to him as well. So I'll throw those two into the mixer here.
I also like, by the way, in this, Emmanuel Augustus, formerly Emmanuel Burton, who had a topsy-turvy record, but he seemed to be written off one day and then come back and give people absolute murders the next, including the likes of Mickey Ward and Floyd Mayweather. If anyone hasn't looked at Emmanuel Augustus or Emmanuel Burton, try and find his highlight reel on YouTube. It's something special. I like this one as well, actually. Good question here from Red Johnny. Ian, I'll start with you. What's the most gutting defeat you commentated on? And did you manage to hide the disappointment in your voice?
I think that has to be Lennox Lewis. It wasn't a defeat. They called it a draw, didn't they? Lennox Lewis, you know, in New York, Madison Square Garden, Evander Holyfield. He's won the fight. He's won the undisputed heavyweight championship, and they don't give it to him. So I did feel angry watching that. You probably shouldn't become emotionally involved. But I had said after about 10 rounds of that, and I was quite pleased I did say it, I said, we have Lennox Lewis well on his way to winning this title fight here. But you've got to remember, we're on a Don King promotion in America. So anything could happen. Let's not try and second guess or count any chickens. Well, that proved to be quite prophetic, didn't it? But yeah, that was the angriest I think I felt. The other one was on a obviously lower profile fight when little Michael Brody of Manchester fought Willie Horeen in I think it was in Manchester, the fight, or on the outskirts of Manchester, can't quite remember, but he was robbed blind that night, and I remember throwing my pen down in exasperation at the end of it and thinking, you know, this guy's, you know, laid everything on the line here. He's had such a tough road to even get this fight, and then they've just taken it away from him for what I felt were political reasons.
John, where are you going with this one?
Well, the Holyfield Lewis one is right up there. I remember saying to Don King, I like Ian, I was furious afterwards, and you know, sort of the brazen I'm struggling for the word for it, but the front of Don King afterwards, you know, with that big cheesy grin on his face to say, hey, we can dance again. We can dance again. You know, in other words, it's happened, and we can have a rematch, and I can make a shed load more money, which I found just incredibly distasteful. Other ones disappointing. I mean, I look back at Harold Graham against Julian Jackson. You know, he had the fight won over there in Spain. He was going to become world champion at last, and he gets knocked out. That was just a bitter disappointment. And I think the two Golovkin Canelo fights, I personally thought the first two, I thought Golovkin won both of them. And I think that he was sawn off by hometown officiating, hometown judges, Las Vegas, you know, sort of viewpoint behind Canelo, and he didn't get a fair roll of the dice. I will always believe that Gennady Golovkin won those first two fights against Canelo, and he should have been the man to have got all that respect.
Surely not Las Vegas, John. Surely not a decision based on commerce in Las Vegas and who sells the most tickets. I remember, I think I can reveal it now. I won't name the referee for fear of lawyers. It's a very litigious world we live in. But I remember a top referee saying to me, Mike Tyson is never going to drop a decision in Las Vegas, which was a real eye-opener, but something we always thought. Here's another one for you. And this isn't me, just to show commentators do get emotionally involved and angry. I sat behind Harry Carpenter covering the 1984 Olympics, and he went absolutely ballistic when Henry Tillman, who was from Los Angeles, got the decision over an Italian. I think his name was Mussoni. Tris will correct me if I'm wrong, in the semi-final. It was an absolute outrage, so much so that the LA crowd booed the decision of their own guy winning. And I remember Harry with his big red felt tip pen putting a big line through all his notes, ripping the page out, screwing it up, and throwing it at the ring.
Wow, great stuff!
little gentlemanly Harry, eh? I going back to what you said about Las Vegas judges there, Ian, you'd have to. After I've been on more than one occasion appalled by some of the judging that I've seen in the States, you know, although I don't think we're a great deal better nowadays, but particularly in the States and Las Vegas. I remember our great old friend Harry Mullen, who used to be editor of Boxing News many years ago, but was a great boxing man and an amazing character, and he would always say that. You know, there'd be that sort of little half smile on his face. It's Las Vegas, John. What do you expect? What do you expect?
Yeah. But I think you raised, you know, I'm digressing a bit here, but we're talking about being angry at scoring and fights. I've always used to feel, and I still feel, they need to clarify exactly what the judges are scoring, because it's too subjective. One guy likes the stylist, another guy likes the, you know, the brawler, and so on. Can't be like that. The fighters have to know this is how this fight will be scored. And the people who score it should be brought to very serious account about how they scored certain fights. That doesn't happen enough for me.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. In terms of the question, by the way, managing to hide disappointment, I think there are two that spring to mind. This will be the last one I answer, because then I'll leave it to you guys. But this one provoked quite strong emotions in me. The first one was the fourth fight between Manny Pacquiao and Juan Manuel Marquez, where Pacquiao was ironed out dramatically. And the reason why I was upset by that wasn't from the way that people think, that I actually thought Manny might have died from the knockout, which was so sensational. It was the fact that the fight was so good, I didn't want it to end. And I was disappointed that the fight had come to a climax. As much as brutal as it was, I was really, really into the fight, and it was a terrific fight. And I suppose with hindsight, you know, it's the knockout that really makes it. But during the fight, I remember thinking, this is great. Imagine 12 rounds of this. And of course, we didn't get that. And then the second one that springs to mind was Hatton's comeback loss to Senchenko, when he turned the Manchester Arena into a morgue. And I remember thinking there were two things. One is, I was obviously writing Ricky's book at the time, and we had about 12 publishers at the table negotiating. With that loss, our 12 publishers went down to one publisher. Which was impactful from a financial perspective, I'm sure. But the thing that I remember most was thinking I was incredibly down. And then I saw Ricky, and I went backstage with him, was in his dressing room, and seeing how content he was when he realized what he once had was no longer there. And it wasn't like I needed reassuring, but it did reassure me in the sense that, well, I can't feel that bad, because he seems to be absolutely fine in terms of he's acceptant of what's happened, and that's what he actually needed to move on with the next phase of his life. So there's my two cents on that. Rob Morris says, do John and Ian think size is overrated in the heavyweight division? Personally, I think Usyk has a great chance of beating Fury. John?
I think size is overrated. I think, you know, I see it and I hear it and I read it again and again and again and again, how the super-sized heavyweights of the current era would be too much for those gone by. You know, I mean, Evander Holyfield and Mike Tyson beat some pretty big guys. Evander's about 6 foot one and a half. Mike Tyson claimed to be 6 foot, but I tell you, he never is. And they were two of the greatest heavyweights that we've seen in our time working within boxing. So yes, I think the size thing is overrated. And I think that even if they were around today, I think Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield would be a big, big problem for any of the heavyweights in the world.
Okay, Ian, let me ask you this, though. Would a good big guy always beat a good little guy?
I think generally speaking, that cliche holds true. And it's why I think Fury will beat Usyk, as strong and as clever and as skillful and fast as Usyk is. I mean, it's a terrific fight, but you'd have to go for Fury because he's probably just a bigger version and he has a wonderful skill set as well. But I think John's right. If you're that little bit smaller, but you have all the talent and heart and all the other things you need to become a top fighter, it doesn't necessarily have to be a problem. But it is fascinating, isn't it, to think that, you know, the likes of Jack Dempsey and Rocky Marciano and Joe Lewis were, well, basically cruiserweights or even less today. So it makes kind of those mythical matchups a little hard to kind of assess in that way. But, you know, they'd have been bigger today, wouldn't they? And they'd have still had the heart and all the skills they had. They just would have been bigger.
Yeah.
Those comparisons are always a little bit invidious, aren't they? Because all you can be is the best of your era. And you don't become an American legend like Dempsey without being able to fight. Likewise, Joe Lewis, you know, yeah, I mean, okay, physically things might have changed, but I don't think we should run away with the idea of that just because Tyson Fury is bigger than Lennox Lewis, that he's a better heavyweight than Lennox Lewis. You know, I mean, I think all you can be is the best of your era.
Yeah. John, let me ask you this one specifically. Stephen Gage says, what do you think of the future of the heavyweight division? Will the big fights happen? Fury versus Usyk, AJ versus Wilder, Fury v. AJ. Do you see them all happening?
Well, the natural cynic in me would say no, because over the years we've seen big fights come and go, the most obvious of them being Riddick Bowe and Lennox Lewis, which was talked about for years. It had happened in the amateurs, of course, but, you know, I mean, so what? As a professional fight, it should have happened, and it never did. You know, I really hope that those big fights that you talk about happen. And you know, AJ and Wilder, what a terrific fight that would be as well. Throw that one into the mix. But and I hope these big fights happen, but too often for political reasons, for promotional reasons, and yes, for television reasons, they don't come about. And I think that boxing loses out if they don't happen.
Yeah, and I think egos get in the way as well, don't they, John and Tris? You know, some people, you know, rival promoters, the rival television channels, you put them in the same room, they can't even agree what tomorrow's date is, let alone try and do a deal or thrash out a deal for a fight. And even though there's a stack of money for a fight like, you know, Fury and AJ, or was up to a couple of years ago, it might be a bit less now, but it's still a stack of money. And people are arguing about what the percentage will be. They're both going to make a fortune. I mean, I'm amazed it never happened. I really am. I mean, talk about looking a gift horse in the mouth. That is incredible. And of course, the fans are the losers. You know, you think back in history, John has mentioned Riddick Bowe, Lennox Lewis, we never got to see. You know, Mike Tyson, Lennox Lewis, we saw too late. You know, going down the divisions, Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao. You know, it happened, you know, so late to have been not irrelevant, but it wasn't the fight it would have been when they were both at their peak. That's what we wanted to see. Like, you know, you want to go back, two fighters at their absolute peak, who we saw together in the ring, the showdown, Sugar Ray Leonard and Tommy the Hitman Hearns. Fantastic. You know, and that era had a lot of those kind of fights. This era, a few less. So, you know, come on, promoters, bang your heads together and get these fights on.
Don't you think that one of the reasons that's the case, though, you know, you go back to that era, Ian, and there wasn't the diversification of television coverage. There weren't the computer streams, you know, the DAZNs, the Amazons. All you had in that era was huge terrestrial television channels. So there wasn't the massive diversification that there is now. So in a sense, it was easier for somebody like Bob Arum to actually cut the deal.
Yeah, that's probably true. That is probably true. I mean, we work in the TV industry, and you know the politics that go on. So doesn't make things very easy at all.
I do think, for fear of depressing everyone as well, we are probably 12 or 18 months beyond seeing Errol Spence and Terence Crawford fight at their best as well. I think that's already gone beyond its sell-by date. And another one we can add to that list is Brook and Khan, which was ridiculous by the time it happened. Ian, we're a bit late to the party on this one. Stephen King's requested you could do an entire episode in your American accent because he really enjoys it.
Well, that's really nice of him to say that. Maybe we can hook up and do that sometime. Yeah.
Great stuff.
Liam, as long as I can do it for. Actually, when I'm in America and I try and do an American accent, everybody says, why are you trying to be like John Wayne?
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Liam Tyra says, I'd love to know what you all think on this. With everything going on in boxing at the minute, with dodgy decisions, PEDs, and fighters seeming to avoid each other, where do you see it going in the future? John, is there any way that we're going to get this all sorted out?
I think it's very, very difficult to even believe that you can begin to sort out performance-enhancing drugs because, you know, the technology of the abuser is always ahead of the technology of the tester. And I think morally, everybody knows that it's a wrong thing. But I think there's probably a lot more of it going on in boxing than we know about. It's in other sports where testing is more rigorous than in boxing. And I think we'd be foolish to think that it's not a lot more widespread than we currently realize. So far as the future of boxing is concerned, you know, it's always kind of seemed to be on the edge of going out of business, hasn't it? You know, you think back to the 1960s when Emil Griffith was involved in that ring tragedy, and the sport almost disappeared from American television screens. But there's something that'll come along. Whether on that occasion it was Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, who came along and kind of reinvented the sport. And I think that you know, long term, I think boxing will continue. Maybe the biggest threat to it, rather than the things that you mentioned, is alternate attractions such as cage fighting, you know, which personally I don't get, but I realize that a lot of people do.
Ian, so someone's asked here, I'd love a story about Naz, what a special talent he was. That's from John Lewis. So obviously we do have a Naz episode, but anything we've not talked about with Naz that springs to mind, any travel stories? And you've obviously got that great anecdote of you seeing him in the not too distant past in a cafe. But back in the day, anything that springs to mind, the weird and wonderful, anything up in Sheffield or interviews as such?
Well, the weird thing was after the cafe episode, and I'll just repeat it for anyone who didn't catch the Naz episode, is he brought his son to my village to play in some tennis tournament. And I was ordering a coffee, as I usually do in my local coffee shop. And a voice behind me said, what are you doing here, darky?
Another great impression.
Him and I got into an hour-long conversation, and then his son turned up later on. And I said, are you going to be a boxer soon? And he said, yeah, and I'll be better than him, pointing at his dad. I said, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But since then, I saw him on a tube train, like somewhere like Piccadilly Circus. You know, he was behind me, and I said hello to him again there, but we were in a very crowded carriage. So that was another quite strange Prince Nassim Hamid experience. He's a more mellow fellow now.
Yeah, as are you, Darky, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, a lot more mellow, yeah.
So, John, you got anything extra on Naz that we've not touched upon yet?
I think we did most of it in the program, didn't we? He was never dull to be around. Put it that way. You can say he was. He could be difficult at times. He could be objectionable, but he could also be absolutely brilliant. And he was of British fighters. Really, I suppose people going further back would say Henry Cooper transcended sport. He became a national celebrity. But really, in the modern era, the one who really broadened the appeal of boxing, I think, was Nazim Hamed. He was huge. He had a sort of a rock star popularity, didn't he?
Yeah, he was box office. Heat, electricity for Generation X, as Steve Bunce once told me. I said, okay, Steve.
Well, it's funny you mention that rock star stuff, because Michael Jackson went out of his way to meet Naz, didn't he? Went out to Neverland, didn't he? To meet him. It's bizarre, but all these guys wanted to meet Naz. Incredible. Jimmy Dixon, no relation, also at James Allen Dixon. This is just some praise for you, Ian. Favorite moments from Ian was commentary on Bo Holyfield 3. When an exhausted-looking Holyfield dropped Bo in a dramatic fashion. Also, you describe in Morales Barrera 1 as a barn burner of a fight during one of the more intense exchanges. And James continues, I was just about to tweet that, he's got him with a left hook. That's extraordinary. What a fighter this Evander Holyfield is. Then him jumping around his room, brilliant commentator. I guess those are great memories for you as well, Ian, right? Those fights and those occasions.
So that's interesting. My brother's calling himself Jimmy Dixon now, is he?
And his Christmas check is in the post, no doubt.
His Christmas check's in the post. No, I mean, that's very nice of him to say that. And John will say the same things. As commentators, when these dramatic moments happen, you just hope that you can come up with a line to match the occasion. Very often you don't, but sometimes you do hit one right on the money. So nice of him to say that. And it's nice always if people do appreciate commentators, because in this era of social media, you tend to get a lot more people slagging you off than saying how good you were.
I suppose the thing is as well, and you guys can both answer this, is when you have those things like, Ian, obviously you're here lit up by this Morales Barrera one, and you're there saying a barn burner of a fight, and then when you say he's got him with a left hook, like, this isn't stuff that you've got written down in front of you. This is you absolutely riding the crest of a wave of emotion, enthusiasm and excitement, isn't it? This isn't, you're not looking at a script here. This is you trying to convey your own excitement, isn't it?
Well, that's commentary. I mean, as you said, you can script magazine programs and script links and all that kind of thing. But commentating on live sport is an ad lib. That is exactly what it is. In boxing, it's a 12 round or however long the fight goes, ad lib. Same, I commentate on football as well. There's nothing really you can plan. You might plan a line for if the upset happens, or you might just, scribble down a little line you might come up with at the end of the fight, if it is an upset result or whichever way it might go. But generally speaking, like that, in the run of the action, no, it's just what comes out. And you've got to be a little bit careful too that you don't get, you're not commentating full throttle the whole way, because I think that can get irritating for the viewers. There's got to be light and shade, and you've got to leave little gaps at times to let people just reflect and watch a little and maybe absorb what you or your co-commentator have just said.
John, which brings me on, I just want to, while we're in this, because I find this fascinating as an outsider of the TV business, really. When you do a fight like Fury Wilder 3, which is up and down, Ian's saying you've got to hold something back, but obviously it's stop-start. You can't really, because it's, you've got to be on for all the dramatic moments. It seemed like every moment was just about dramatic in a fight like that.
Yeah, you have to have, I mean, another little phrase that we use within the business is that you kind of have to have gears. You ease back when things are not dramatic, And then when they explode into you know, something really extraordinary, then that's when you have to find words to go with it, and you have to be able to convey the emotion. So you're kind of mixing it. You have to be analytically cute, but at the same time, you have to be able to go with the excitement of the occasion to reflect what people are watching, and to help them share that excitement. Because I think that's what you're doing. You're helping people to enjoy it rather than telling them to enjoy it. So I think you're just sort of the best plaudit you can have is if somebody says that they feel as though they're sitting next to you and that they're enjoying it with you. And just to add to what Ian says about going along on the crest of a wave, I mean, one of the things I absolutely despise in all forms of commentary, whether it be football, rugby, cricket, boxing or whatever, is where people are absolutely sticking irrelevant stats down your throat for minute after minute after minute, instead of looking at what's actually happening and trying to analyse why it's happening. I think there's far too much of that nowadays in commentary, and I think that sports commentary is very much worse for it.
Yeah, I mean, you think back to commentators that went before us, great commentators. You know, Reg Guttridge's style was quite anecdotal, wasn't it? You know, and blokish. But, you know, he could hit the lines, couldn't he, when it came to it? Do you remember his line with the Holyfield-Tyson fight? That's the biggest upset in the fight game, bar none. You know, so lines that reverberate. And Harry Carpenter, you know, Rumble in the Jungle, I'll always remember it. You know, oh, my God, he's won the world title back at 32. I mean, he just caught it. That what a sensation it was. You know, Harry Carpenter saying, "Oh my God!" You know, I loved all that.
Didn't Reg when Naz was fighting, when he used to do that flip over the ropes? Was it not he who was the first to say, "The ego has landed"?
Yeah, great line. Great line. Yeah.
Some good stuff there, gents. So talking about actually some of the greats from the past in terms of the guys that cover the sport, the Motor City Cobra says, "Hi, gents, loving the pod. The book that really got him into boxing when he was a kid was one by Harry Mullen, Boxing in the Last 25 Years from W.H. Smith, no less. Harry sounded like a legend. Which writers inspired you to get into boxing as youngsters, or was it another form?" So that's an interesting question. I suppose when I was, you know, the voices of my youth, sorry, Ian, was you and Glenn, or you and Jim.
God, you're aging me now.
apologies. But how, you know, was there a voice of your generation when you were watching it? Was it the radio, or were there writers that you made sure you consumed back in the day? And I guess I'm talking 50s and 60s.
Yeah. When I used to listen to those early fights on the radio, there was Raymond Glendenning and W. Barrington Dalby doing the minutes summarizing in a rather sort of pompous style between the rounds. I can remember it. But later on, there was a guy from Birmingham called Simon Smith, who I used to think had a great voice for boxing. Nobody ever really talks about him. He used to be on the radio. He was one of the radio commentators. Stuart McPherson, who was Canadian. Eamon Andrews. And later, Des Lynam, you know, who I had the privilege of working alongside. Des was doing the commentary, and I just used to go along and do the interviews. That happened just for a year before he went to television and became the superstar he became. But, you know, he taught me a lot just listening and watching the way he conducted himself around fights and fighters, even in that short period we were together. You know, a wonderful, wonderful broadcaster. He was a very good radio boxing commentator, too, if you listen back to, you know, the old fights that he did in that era. He did that fight when Lloyd Hannigan beat Don Curry in America.
Wow, okay.
Simon Smith did the commentary when Cassius Clay, as he was, when he got knocked down by Henry Cooper. That was Simon on that occasion. He didn't do it for a great many years, but yeah, he did have a lovely voice.
He did. He wrote me a lovely letter once as well when I started doing it, and saying, you know, you might just want to do a little bit more of that, but I'm really enjoying what you're doing, and you know, keep going. And I was kind of like, I was gobsmacked to get the letter from him.
Nice thing to do, isn't it?
I think
of writers, I'd go along with the guy who asked the question and say, you know, Harry Mullen was just a terrific writer, and I've got some of his anthologies tucked away in my book collection somewhere, and now and again I go back and reread them. And for a man who was never a boxer, never had the gloves on, as far as I know, he had a remarkable way of getting into a fighter's mind and into the real meaning of a fight. And you talk about the beauty of boxing. Harry knew and understood the beauty of boxing as much as the corruption of boxing. And I think on a slightly more sort of wordy and self-regarding way, I guess you have to admire the writing of Hugh McIlvany, who was an absolutely outstanding boxing journalist for many a year. And if you go back and find his writing about the tragic demise of Johnny Owen back in, was it 1981, you know, the stuff he wrote then was just I think it was as good as anything which has ever been written about boxing anywhere.
Yeah, and his memorable line about Johnny Owen was, and he did this as a runner, as the journalists call it, on the phone as things were going on, and his last line of his piece for the Sunday Times was, the tragedy of Johnny Owen was that he was articulate in the most dangerous language of all, which is, you know, is some line to describe Johnny.
You wish you'd been able to say something yourself like that. That is an extraordinary piece of writing.
It is an extraordinary piece of writing, especially doing it almost off the top of his head. But without being too grovelly, I think we should say a word about Triss as well here, you know, John, because you know the stuff Triss, the stuff you're coming out with, Triss, these life stories are fantastic insights. I'm not sure anybody's ever done that in the history of boxing. You know, you've done 200 of them, haven't you now?
Yes.
And I think I'm right in saying the series is quite a big hit, isn't it, in the business?
I think it's doing okay. Yeah, I think people enjoy it. Yeah, it's nice. And like you said, I think there's nothing like it. And I sort of do try and get people from all walks of life in boxing, whether it's journeymen, contenders, Hall of Famers, trainers, broadcasters. I'm just hugely grateful to the people who've helped.
You have to have a fantastic depth of knowledge. And I think, again, you know, I mean, this sounds like blowing smoke up you, but you do it, you make it succeed because you understand and know the people who you're talking to and what they've tried to achieve over the years. And I think for that reason, it's a great listen.
Yeah, and that's why people want to talk to you, Triss, I think, because then they know you're empathetic with the business.
Ian, this is where I say that Jimmy Dixon was actually Triss Dixon, who was talking about your favourite moments on commentary.
Yeah.
But yes,
and by the way, haven't you got a new book? I think you've got a new book out, haven't you?
People should
buy it.
It's called Warrior, and you can buy it now.
Right now.
Okay, look, one more and then we'll wrap this up. So this is a great question from Liam Brett, and it got me thinking about several things, actually, and someone's prompted in the replies here already. So was there ever a rivalry you saw that had begun but never got settled and you wish it had been? A fight that promises a rematch but never happened, etc., and should have. So Terry Hall's instantly intervened and said, Bo Lewis has to be right up there, and obviously it does. You know, they had the whole bin in the trash can and all the rest of it. And I think the thing that probably misses the most for me is when we've had the opportunities for these round robins of fights and they've just never happened. And I remember, Ian, you'll remember this from your Sky days, Takalu, Wayne Alexander, Jamie Moore, Stevie Roberts, Richard the Secret Williams, none of them fought each other apart from Wayne Alexander and Takalu at one point. And we had this like rich vein of 154 pounders. And we seem to have had this multiple times where we've had, you know, four or five top guys, and they've just not met each other for whatever reason domestically. I don't know. So obviously Liam and Terry, they have mentioned Bo and Lewis. Rawley, in terms of you, and the fights that got away and the ones that, you know, the feuds that were never settled.
Yeah, there's one which stands out, I think, which should have happened. I'm not saying it would have been a great fight, and it may well not have been, but it should have happened. And that's Ricky Hatton and Junior Witter. You know, I mean, they talked about that one for goodness knows how long, and we were told, oh, it wouldn't sell. Witter would stink the place out. But, you know, there's parts of me which thinks that at his very best, Junior Witter would have given Ricky Hatton absolute nightmares. It could have been a very good fight, and I think it's a shame, really, that it never happened. That you know, that's boxing. It happens too often, unfortunately. Quality fights don't get made.
We might have just lost Ian there, but we can soldier on. He might be having a technical glitch. But one thing,
not unusual, as you know.
one thing that does spring to mind actually here is when you get these cross-generational fights as well, and sometimes they happen and sometimes they don't, and sometimes you get the passing of the torch. Now, I was never into Calzaghe v. Froch because they were different generations to me, but there was a window there where it would have been an acceptable fight, even if Calzaghe was on the downside and Froch was starting to become the Carl Froch that we would know and actually has just been inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. And there was a rivalry there, wasn't there? There was something there. There was a dislike. They were talking about each other. Didn't happen. Was that a big miss for you, or are you in my camp there in the sense that it was just different times?
I don't really go with that one because, you know, I talked about Hatton and Witter, and that should have happened when they were both in their prime. You know, Joe is before Carl, really. And I think in his prime, I think Joe would have been just too much for Carl Froch. I think he's a southpaw for a start, and I think he'd have been just too quick for Froch, and that he'd have outworked him as much as anything. But yeah, it could have happened, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who are listening to this now saying, "Oh, come on, you're not giving Froch the credit that he deserves," and he'd have found a way to beat Calzaghe. But you know, I mean, Carl. Nobody ever talks about his fight against Andre Ward, do they? He had some great wins, but he also found his level there. And I think had he fought Joe Calzaghe in his prime, then I think it would have been a question of levels, and I think Joe would have been one above. And by the time that the fight could have happened, when Joe was just trying to milk it, fighting Roy Jones and Bernard Hopkins and getting some decent paydays in the fag end of his career. By the time that was on, I think it was probably too late for Joe. And at that stage, it's quite possible that Carl would have beaten him. And I think he knew that. And I think that's why he was so keen on taking the fight.
I suppose it's an interesting study when you look at Calzaghe, because he did get the fight with Eubank in that cross-generational thing where Eubank was at the tail end and Joe was coming through. And really, it was Joe's first big signature win in many respects. And obviously, maybe it was the wrong thing to do for Eubank to be knocking around with the younger guys by that. Maybe that was a lesson learned from Joe, learned from Eubank. You know, get out before the young guns start coming through. What was interesting, I think, about Lennox, who we've talked about a few times already today, was Lennox obviously cleared out your Holyfields and your Tysons and that lot. And then he started on the next batch, which I thought was great. You know, the Michael Grants, the David Tours, the Vitali Klitschkos. That was great stuff to sort of really start putting a dent in a second era of great heavyweights. I think we have lost Ian, which is a shame, but we're wrapping up. And there is one final story here that someone has shared before we leave, John. And it's from AD Stott, who says, "I was sat in an empty arena with my pal, who was boxing on the show later that evening. And Ian came and sat with us for a chat. When he got up to leave, my pal said, 'Nice.'" He said, "Nice to meet you, Colin." Ian just laughed and said, "It's nice to know I'm making an impact in the trade." goodness.
Memories, memories. Yeah, Ian's got a great sense of humour, and he's very self-deprecating with that sort of thing. But it's lovely. It's lovely being able to do this series with him, because I know, you know, from my early days in boxing commentating and reporting, he was somebody I looked up to, and I think he's one of the outstanding boxing commentators on either side of the Atlantic. And it's still lovely to hear his reminiscences now, isn't it? And that something like that is absolutely priceless.
It's great. And it's a great way to end today. So, guys, thank you very much for joining me, John, and Colin, apparently. and we will be back next week. Take care, everybody.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.